Hello and welcome to Not Another Science podcast. I'm Kelsey.
And I'm Katie. And today we have a special episode with our sponsors, Griner Bio One. We talked to Nermina Chuzovic, Global Sustainability Manager at Griner Bio One and Executive Assistant to the CEO. Nermina tells us the role that companies should have in reducing emissions and setting climate targets, particularly suppliers of laboratory plastics like GBO.
As usual, and especially relevant to this episode, this podcast is sponsored by Griner Bio One, manufacturers and direct suppliers of laboratory and medical products to academia, research, pharmaceutical, biotechnology, and healthcare organisations globally. For details of their extensive product range, please visit www.gbo.com.
And now in this episode, you can find out a lot more about our sponsors and the projects they're involved in trying to reduce waste and CO2 emissions in their manufacturing and supply chain.
Well, thank you for having me on this podcast, first of all, and a little bit about me. My name is Nermina Chuzovic. I'm dialing in actually from Austria, and I'm currently serving in a dual role at Griner Bio One International. I'm the executive assistant to our CEO and also the global sustainability manager. So basically, I'm responsible for developing, implementing, actively driving our sustainable strategies initiatives within the company, and also in alignment with our corporate sustainability plan, because we are just one of the three divisions under Griner AG. And this position allows me to be kind of at the forefront of our environmental, social, and ethical responsibilities, and to kind of work towards aligning those responsibilities with our long-term sustainability goals. What I kind of hope within this role is to contribute to a more sustainable future.
Yeah. I think actually we should probably quickly ask you to explain a bit about what Griner does as a company and what products you make, just for listeners who aren't aware.
So GBO or Griner Bio One, our beloved short-term abbreviation, is a division of Griner AG, and we offer products and services for biotech, medical devices, in vitro diagnostics, and research. We focus on customer orientation, high product quality, and innovative product solutions. We have two business unit. One is pre-analytics and the other is bioscience, and our portfolio includes products within both of these business units. So blood collection tubes, cell culture, high throughput screening, even COVID-19 testing most recently. And we also have significant focus on sustainability to make our operations more environmentally friendly. We have more than 2,300 employees and 29 subsidiaries. We have production sites in 7 locations in Austria, Germany, Hungary, USA, Brazil, and Thailand, and having 2 in Austria, so that accounts for 7. Basically, we were established within the Griner Group in 1963, and our production kind of started with the manufacture of our first Petri dish. And yeah, you know us as a global leader in high quality plastic products for the diagnostics, biotech, and pharmaceutical industries.
Thank you. So maybe just to give our audience an idea of like the scope of sustainability issues, like what's the amount of plastic or like waste production that might be a result of like scientific companies that need to produce so much basically technology for scientists to use in an efficient way, but also like a clean way to make sure there's no like contamination or anything?
Because it is all single-use plastic.
Yes, definitely, because contamination and cross-contamination is a big thing. However, to go back to your question, the amount of waste produced by scientific companies, it really varies greatly depending on the type of industry and the type of scientific company. So we cannot talk the same waste, whether we are a manufacturer like GBO or the end user like the University of Edinburgh, because we don't have the same processes involved. But in looking at the, I would say, examples that are kind of close to you, there was a recent study completed by the University of Exeter, and their Department of Bioscience generates about 267 tons of plastic a year.
Wow.
So yeah, that, I mean, that's a huge amount. But as I said, you cannot, like, in terms of the medical waste, or waste in general produced by scientific companies, you have to look at the phases in which these companies are. So maybe a production phase you would not have at the university, but you would have more intense research and development phase, you know. And these R&D activities would contribute to waste production or, you know, biomedical research, samples, reagents, animal tissues, even electronic waste, you know, obsolete prototypes of any electronic components, like end-of-life disposal.
Yeah,
this is what the manufacturing, like we as a manufacturer do not have to deal with this, mm-hmm. but you as an end user do. So what is, what happens with I don't know, the tubes, the pipettes, the petri dishes, when it becomes waste. So expired chemicals, all the electronic waste that you don't have use for, you know. So again, really depends on the type of the company. But any CSR responsibility strategy or initiative should basically encourage companies to minimize this waste, to recycle where possible, and to, you know, kind of adopt sustainable practices. And what scientific companies could do, you know, from recycling to lean manufacturing to circular economy, this basically implement these practices into their everyday business.
Yeah, and do you think there's a role then for the companies to be, the companies aren't necessarily the ones throwing away the plastic at the end point, that is the researcher, but should there be pressure coming from companies for researchers to try and reduce waste where possible? I suppose don't necessarily want to be throwing things away where you don't need to, and most people are very trying not to waste as much as possible, but is there anything the kind of companies that manufacture things can do?
Well, definitely the manufacturers and research companies, scientific companies could potentially partner in the waste reduction programs, but also within the scientific companies, you, like as an end user or a customer, could have responsible procurement practices. So when you order, they order in bulk, that you don't have, you know, wasteful ordering. And also what you can do is basically pick from companies that have already kind of committed themselves to, let's say, maybe science-based targets. They have sustainable practices, and they're producing already some green products.
So could you kind of describe what, like, how you would set targets to try and reduce single-use plastic usage or just any type of waste products that might come as a result of just being in scientific research?
Mm-hmm. Well, science-based targets is definitely one way to align with the latest climate science to meet the goals of the Paris Agreement. I'm sure that everyone heard about the Paris Agreement, and is our long-term goal is to keep the temperature, or, you know, the kind of the rise in the mean global temperature below 2 Celsius. So what a science-based target is a greenhouse emission reduction target that aligns with this goal. Mm-hmm. And Griner Bio One, actually Griner, our parent company, we are, as of September, when we have verified our science-based targets, we were one of 24 companies in Austria that have confirmed science-based targets. And with the science-based targets, we have committed to reduction of greenhouse gas emissions that are calculated on scientific basis. And there is actually a kind of a process, like a five-step process that is involved in this. So first, what we did, we submitted a letter establishing our intent to set the science-based targets. Then we worked kind of, you know, we developed a framework. So we developed this emission reduction target framework kind of in line with the science-based targets criteria. You can go on their website and see how this is done in detail. And then what we did, we submitted and we presented our targets for official validations. And this came back in September 2023, and our science-based targets were validated. What we then did, we communicated this target and informed our stakeholders. And in the future, now from now on, we have to report company-wide emissions and track these targets and the progress annually. So what our science-based targets, the ones that we have committed to and what has been validated and improved, is basically that we as a company commit to reducing absolute scope 1 and 2 GHG emissions 60% by 2030 from a base year of 2021. And also, we also committed to reduce our absolute scope 3 GHG emissions from fuel and energy related activities. And this kind of relates to upstream transportation and distribution and downstream transportation and distribution and the end of life treatment of solid products, so 25% within the same time frame. And what we also did, we further committed that 80% of our suppliers by emissions covering purchased goods and services will have science-based targets by 2027. So the supply chain, because scope 3 emissions are in our CO2 budget accounting, they account for more than 90% of our emissions. So, and these are like the hardest ones to control because we have limited influence to scope 3 emissions. And this is why it's more important that we closely work with our suppliers and customers to implement circular business models. And since we are part of like a three division company, we have group-wide targets. And this, our key approach would be, because the other two divisions, they produce consumer plastics, like yogurt cups and, you know, plastic containers, so packaging, plastic packaging, and Nivion produces foam for various applications. So our key approach in the future would be to use even more recycled materials, so across all three divisions, and to design our products so that they can be recycled after use.
Yeah, yeah. I seem to see a lot of the things I use in the lab is all more in the paper packaging than maybe it used to be, which is good to see. So if you're trying to reduce emissions, because it seems like the distribution and delivery and things are all quite a good way to reduce emissions. Are there many emissions, like what's the scale of emissions produced in the actual plastic manufacturing? I don't really know much about that, but is that somewhere to cut down, or is the kind of distribution and shipping quite a big area?
I would say like transportation, the industry, the manufacturing, they're all kind of equally there when it comes to the emissions. I would say transportation, electricity, electricity management, and the manufacturings are equally there. One is like, you know, a couple of points more or less around quarter of all emissions globally. So yes, for us, it's like a big, really chunk, and we have to work really, really hard to bring those down, not only our emissions, but the ones that we don't have direct influence over, that's our suppliers. So that's why we have to carefully choose our suppliers and that they also commit to the same values that we do.
So you're saying that there's not much that can be done in terms of single-use plastics, but you're trying to target other areas of the company that are a bit more actionable in terms of like trying to drive emissions down, I guess.
Well, yeah, the single-use plastic, we still have to produce it because, you know, it has shown historically that it, you know, it's a better product, and you have minimized any accidents when it compared to, let's say, glassware, you know, glass labware. However, there are alternatives and alternative strategies that could potentially be used to minimize the environmental impact of plastic. So definitely one of them would be recyclability. And I would say in bioscience products, a little bit easier to implement compared to, let's say, pre-analytics, because you know that the tubes and the pre-analytics products are heavily regulated. they have to go through clinical trials, and then you have to have a certain quality of the product in order to pass. So implementing recycled materials there is at this point tough, but it's not impossible. So this will be something on the horizon in the years to come. However, we also can maybe lower the impact of our plastic in shipping and manufacturing. So like, for example, some of our internal examples would be to optimize or invest in custom size packaging. And this would be to use tailored packaging to improve space efficiency in transit, which then would also reduce CO2 emissions on both sides, on our side and also on the customer side. Also, what would be possible is to minimize the void fill in secondary packaging materials, so the optimized stackability of inner and outer packaging. So if you have optimized transport, then you're also saving not only money, but you're reducing CO2 emissions. Also, utilizing packaging design, innovative elimination. I remember this, I think it was one of the beer producers. They have replaced the plastic rings. If you know those plastic rings that hold six packs, they've replaced it with dots of glue that stick the cans together. Mm. So that, yeah. And I mean, it's pretty innovative. I mean, it's not like rocket science, but it's a step further in elimination of plastics. So this would be like, direct elimination, innovative elimination, optimization of packaging. So this is all these are all ways to reduce plastic impact.
So like you've mentioned like the cost being reduced as well by this, like by just reducing packaging. Do you find that you have to like kind of negotiate with like the wider company when it comes to like setting targets or is it kind of everyone comes together and is like, let's try and make this in a way that like saves us money, but it's also good for the environment? Or do you have to have like a kind of push and pull kind of discussion about what's going to take priority, I guess?
Well, the thing is, if you're negotiating, like science-based targets, then you have to have, clear commitment, of course, and a clear communication strategy. So you have to communicate and articulate the benefits of setting the targets. And this involves like a wide range of stakeholders. However, if you're doing like maybe a packaging optimization project, where we could kind of potentially save money and also improve our sustainability score, and also not only ours, but also the customer's sustainability score, this could be done within the company itself. So within the a department that is in charge of this. And of course you would have to have a buy-in and kind of approval from the senior management, but because if kind of this project comes in as an idea, it has to fit in like the annual plan and what you're doing, and the resources need to be found from, in terms of time and person and whoever needs to be involved in such a project. But if there is a clear cut message that this would make an impact, that this would save money, and that the benefits kind of outweigh the costs, then I don't see why this could not be done. And this then is like an internal thing. Of course, after it's completed, then it would be communicated also to the rest of the company, to our global colleagues. So this potentially could be a replicated project.
Yeah. And how do you go about trying to influence other companies to take on more sustainable goals and sign up to science-based targets, etc.?
Well, it's kind of easier said easier said than done. Definitely being a leader in what you're doing, but it depends from which angle you're looking at it. If I'm looking from my angle, or you're looking from your angle working or studying at the university, so there are several ways that you could persuade your management or other like within the company and then set an example to other universities. So we could definitely raise awareness. I mean, we have resources within our sustainability team to use our internal communication channels to highlight the importance of, you know, climate positive actions. But also we use our external channels to do this. So I'm sure that whoever is looking up to us is probably reading what we are doing. They're reading our reports that we have and what we've been doing in, you know, last couple of years or a decade. So this is a good way to model the behavior. So social proof. That's what it is. So if they're doing something really good, we should be doing something really good as well. Also within our industry and the products that we produce, we can advocate for policy changes, and we also could potentially support climate positive businesses in our supply chain. We will choose to buy from companies that, you know, prioritize sustainability practices. So if you want to do business with us, you have to prove that you have the same values and that you stand for the same things as we do. Again, easier said than done, because a lot of companies have just started on this journey. Of course, this sends them a clear message, you know, what our preferences are. We also get these messages as a company, you know, because we are a customer on the other end. So yeah, these are all kind of ways that we can persuade, put pressure on others. So we could also, it might sound small, but we can share information about the climate change and the impacts and the positive things that we've done within our own circles, you know, with our friends and family and community. And this would reach, I would say, other companies.
You've kind of like mentioned that now as a bigger company, you can like put pressure on your suppliers and like you're also getting like advice and pressure from other companies. Do you think there's been like a change? I feel like previously it was a lot of governments were kind of handing down targets to companies and saying you have to follow these rules. Do you find that there's now like a culture shift where the companies are kind of being a bit more taking the lead on trying to like reduce their emissions rather than just taking advice from like governments?
I don't think that this is an advice from the government. These are clear requirements, and these requirements are getting more stringent as we speak. Because we have, you know, I mean, it might sound corny, but there's no planet B. we have no choice. And this is something that we collectively have to do together. So whether we are consumers, whether we are producers, these are the things that need to be done and need to be done soon. So these, I would say, requirements and whatever you want to call them, directives, laws, they're there, you know, for a reason. Because otherwise it would be like a nice to have option. And of course, each company wants to maximize profits. And then I would say the sustainability topics would then just kind of fall behind. There needs to be a lot more awareness, of course. And I also the fossil fuels. Yeah, this is the topic that, again, needs a lot of pressure from the public. It needs to be communicated that every single individual understands what this means and what this means for us and for our future and future of our children. So yes, a company can be like altruistic, you know, from its core, but I don't think that's enough. You do have to have a set of laws. You have to have regulations that govern this and that are super stringent when it comes to fulfilling these and monitoring these, because then we know that we are on the right path.
So government pressure does work.
It does. I mean, it has to, because, you know, I mean, the government pressure, it's like a monetary pressure. So, you know, we're going to, you know, take the money out of your pockets if you don't comply with this. Yes, that's the kind of pressure that you yet that you need. I mean, up to now, it has been possible to, I don't know, buy carbon credits or whatever to substitute your bad practices with something good, but that's just then zero sum game.
An excuse, yeah.
It's an excuse, but then you just, it's you know, it's a zero. It's no, there's no progress. So you have not made any progress. You have not contributed to the betterment of the planet or the environment. Mm. So this needs to be changed. And the more pressure that the governments, I mean, these policies exert on companies, yeah, the better. And we all have to do this together.
Yeah. So I guess you've said like that basically governments just need to apply like pressure and like place laws to make sure that companies don't kind of wiggle the way out of like these guidelines, well, out of the directives. Mm-hmm. Do you think mm-hmm. that there's like some actions that definitely need to be taken like basically immediately that aren't being taken currently by like producers of scientific technology that you like personally feel that really needs to be happening in the next 10, 20 years rather than trying to push it down the line?
Well, all our actions need to happen in the next 10 to 20 years, actually in the next decade, to keep this target at bay. Otherwise, once we kind of cross this point of no return, then it would be really, really hard to do it and like really to see the benefits of it. So we have to reduce the emissions, and the three, I would say, top sectors where we could reduce these emissions are the industry. This is the manufacturing contributes to carbon dioxide emissions, like CO2 emissions, then the transportation and the electricity production. So I think that out of these, transportation is the highest. The sector generates the largest share of CO2 equivalent emissions. And this comes from burning fossil fuel oils. And then, of course, the cars, trucks, planes, you know, again, back to fossil fuels. Basically, what companies can do is they can use their purchasing power to drive change in their supply chain. This is what we already discussed. And I think it's Apple that launched a supplier clean energy program. And now they have hundreds of suppliers that are committed to using 100% renewable energy for all Apple manufacturing. So this is something similar that we also have at GBO. It's this purchase of green electricity and these targets that we have set within our science-based targets. And this also involves that by 2025, we would have 80% of purchased green electricity and 100% by 2030. So this is like a clear target and a clear example. Also investing in renewable energy, you know? I think the international information and communication technology industry, I think they use like by far the most energy and they're the largest purchaser of renewable energy. And this has significantly reduced their emissions because they've been investing in urban energy and energy efficiency. So at Griner and at GBO, we have also invested in this basically solar panels to produce our own energy. So this not only benefits the environment, but it also leads to more efficient operations and lower costs because we are generating our own electricity and harnessing the power of sun.
Yeah, it's like exciting to think that there's like going to be a more circular energy production and that there won't be so much moving of fossil fuels between companies and different spaces, and that we might get a future where people are internally making their own energy and not in a renewable way.
Yeah, there's lots that can be done to,
of course, but it requires a strategy. It requires that you know, that all stakeholders are on board when it comes to this, that you have clear commitment but also resources to do this. And this is also the hardest part. Sometimes you do have the commitment but you don't have the resources, and then this is prolonged and put on hold until some other things kind of, you know, take priority and until kind of better times come. And this is where governments, we talked about this, this is where the governments can help and subsidize these efforts, you know, promote these efforts, have promotional programs where, you know, these practices are favored over the others.
Yeah, whatever hit is taken now in terms of like implementing changes to like just production and renewable energy is going to be like so much smaller in comparison to like what we'll see. And
you have to do you have to fix that, but people don't understand it. The governments don't understand that until it happens, and we cannot afford that to happen at larger scales and more frequent scales. So these things are, you know, the tsunamis, the floods, the melting of the ice sheets, and what it's happening, you know, quite often now, you know, something that was not as often, like maybe 100, 200 years ago. It's happening more often right now. Yeah.
So hopefully moving on to a more positive note. What's your personal biggest hope for like the future in climate space, maybe outside of Greiner Bio One, and just in terms of what would you like to see coming out of all these big conferences, what people can do personally?
Well, since you two come from kind of the educational institution, I would like to see more climate education and awareness coming from the universities, from the professors, also from like active actions on university campuses, you know, that students really teach other students, that professors teach students. So it's like a peer-to-peer education and understanding and awareness about the impacts of climate change. And, you know, the steps that individuals can take that you can reduce your own carbon footprint. So you might, oh yeah, I'm just a single person. Well, if every single person at 7 billion of us took a little tiny step, that would be one huge step. Also, what I would, and we already touched upon this, are the policy changes. I would like to see in this really, really unstable world, more like decisive action. I understand it's really hard when we have like recession and we have inflation and we're talking about a conflict here and a conflict there and a promise of another conflict on another end of the globe. It's really hard to even think about, you know, decisive actions when it comes to climate sustainability. But this is something that I would really like to see, that the hostilities stop and that we kind of together as like, you know, citizens of the world work on limiting the greenhouse gas emissions and like promoting sustainable practices. Also would like to see companies shift away from fossil fuels where possible and towards renewable energy. Like solar, wind, hydroelectric power, and these carbon capture technologies. This would be something that I would love to see come up with also the startups who are working on this, that we have the development and implementation of technologies that can effectively capture and store carbon dioxide emissions. This is something that I would like to see like really soon in the near future, and not like, you know, 10, 15 years from now. Everyone is talking about these, you know, software development, IT services, blockchain, this and that. You know, maybe the kind of the shift from the startups should go towards the carbon capture technologies.
That's good. Yeah, we just need the urgent change. So how would you get into a career in trying to make these changes and reduce emissions?
Well, this would be interesting because you don't have to go to university and say, okay, I want to study sustainability, I want to study whatever. There are many, many paths, and from, you know, different degrees and different majors, you can go into the sustainability field. So for example, if you're studying science, environmental climate science on it, or any other bioscience, you could go into promoting sustainable development, you know, by doing research, by developing policies, or, you know, implementing environmental management strategies, and so on and so forth. Engineering also very similar. Of course, environmental engineer would have like a slightly different path, I would say. You would look into the principles of engineering, maybe land science, biology, chemistry, to develop solutions to environmental problems, but also R&D. This is where engineering comes in super handy, because R&Ds in, I would say, scientific companies, they work on sustainable product design and green products. So if you want to have kind of a future in sustainability, this would be a really cool path, because you could design green products that would have minimal environmental impact. Then my path has been, I would say, a mix. I've studied in economics and finance. I also have a degree in international affairs. I have a master's in business management. But if you're coming from economics or any kind of social science, you go into a sustainability manager or sustainability director position, and you oversee company sustainability strategy, waste management, green building, you know, corporate social responsibility, and so on and so forth. If you think that you cannot get into sustainability with IT, you can, and it's a very sought after specialization. You could be a sustainability data specialist. Also, public policy, public management, I would say, and also international affairs and relations. So you can be, like, for example, a grant writer or a project manager who writes proposals to secure funding. So international affairs would be more on an intergovernmental or supranational level, like EU or intergovernmental bodies on environment, UN, and so forth. So if you're talking about Millennium Development Goals or Sustainability Development Goals within the UN, this is kind of the field that you could come from. So basically, from, I would say, most degrees and majors out there at undergraduate and graduate level, you can move into sustainability.
Yeah, it's really interesting that, like, basically every career can be involved with sustainability in some way.
Lots of options, yeah.
Exactly, because it's such a wide and vast area. There's not a single person that can cover everything. It would be, like, impossible. So people work together, and then as a result, you have a company sustainability strategy that drives us forward.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear from a company's perspective on what's happening.
A lot, definitely a lot is happening. However, this is, I would say, we just kind of scratched on the surface what needs to be done, and we have to roll up our sleeves. And I would say, in the next 5 to 6 years, really put our efforts together to get there.
That was really interesting to hear from a company's perspective, how they can have the power to influence suppliers and other businesses in their sector. And although companies need to be doing all they can in the face of the climate crisis, we also need to put pressure on governments.
If you'd like to hear more about other projects trying to minimise effects of the climate crisis, last season we had an episode talking to researchers from the Edinburgh Earth Initiative, Alice, Elizabeth and Sarah, who were working on projects digging into the history of the University of Edinburgh's connections to the fossil fuel industry. And they talk more generally about the impact of the climate crisis worldwide and the responsibility we have in the West and the global North to minimise the impact of the crisis we've created. It's a great episode, and it's called The Fuel Behind Climate Conversations, and you should definitely check it out.
If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a follow on Spotify or wherever you're listening to this episode, so you don't miss the fab guests we have in the works this season. This podcast is brought to you by Edinburgh University Science Media, bringing you exciting conversations about the science being done by our very own staff and students here at the university and beyond. You can find out more about us and read the latest issue of our magazine at usci.org.uk. That's EUSCI.
We are a student-run society, so if any Edinburgh-based students would like to get involved, keep an eye on our social media. There are lots of opportunities to write, edit, and illustrate for our magazine. We are on Instagram at usci_media and Twitter or X at usci. And any feedback and suggestions for this podcast are always welcome, either via our social media or by dropping us an email at usci.podcast@gmail.com.
This episode was hosted by Katie Pickup and me, Kelsey Tetley-Campbell. The podcast logo was designed by Apple Chew, and the podcast episode art was designed by Elizabeth Carmichael. The intro music is an edited version of Funkarama by Kevin MacLeod, and the outro music is an edited version of Footballs in Space by Professor Colin Campbell.
Thank you for listening, and until next time, keep it science.